I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. What would cause a young man described by friends, coaches, and teachers as a good kid to commit a terrible act of violence? That's one of the many questions being asked about Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the 19-year-old Boston Marathon bombing suspect who is in serious condition in the hospital. His brother, 26-year-old Tamerlan, was killed during the manhunt last week that shut down that region. How can we make sense of what these two brothers are accused of doing, and what can we learn about how to prevent future acts of violence against innocent victims? We asked Dr. John Horgan to join us, director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism and an associate professor of psychology at Penn State University. He's written a number of books about terrorism and terrorists. He's also a member of the Research Advisory Board of the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. And John Horgan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. If you could talk to Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who is in the hospital and apparently unable to speak so far, what would you want to ask him? And I ask you that because I know you have interviewed a number of terrorists.
I have indeed. Gosh, that's a tricky question. I think right now the high-value detainee interrogation group, or the HIG, a group most people wouldn't really have heard of before the events of recent days, will be discussing that very issue. They will be thinking about the way in which they might approach him, the way in which they might probe different issues to get him to open up. One of the issues I would really focus on, if it emerges that Dzhokhar in particular is religiously motivated in some way, is to make him mindful of the fact that he is alive, and that he is alive because God wants him to be alive. And I think that represents a very important starting point to get him to open up. I don't think, I'm speculating here, but I really don't think he expected to survive this.
And I'm curious that you say that, and I have to say, as we talk about this, there's so much that we don't know, bits and pieces coming out in the newspaper. I know he is injured and therefore cannot speak, and there are some questions about whether that injury to his neck was self-inflicted or whether it was as a result of shootouts with the authorities up in Boston. Is that why you wonder about whether he expected to live or not?
Actually, no. I think it relates to issues far much earlier on in the process. Engaging in terrorism like this is in reality a very, very high-risk activity, and very, very few who engage in it, particularly many of the examples we've seen of homegrown terrorism in the U.S. over the past few years, people don't expect to survive. They don't expect to be taken alive. They certainly don't expect to be facing interrogation. There certainly is likely to be a lot of fear, anger, resentment, the fact that he was caught, the fact that his brother is dead. But I think the interrogators and the interviewers are going to be faced with a very difficult challenge of bringing him around to the realization that he is alive, and he's alive for a reason, and that there has to be an incentive, if you like, for him to talk. As you've probably seen, like we all have, there's a lot of turmoil in the Tsarnaev family right now, and I don't think that would necessarily make for the best starting point. But he needs to feel that he has a reason to live and a reason to pull through this.
We're talking about two brothers who are suspects in this bombing attack. Is that significant from your perspective and your experience with terrorism?
It's certainly far more common. I was actually surprised by a lot of the commentary that this represented something new or something unusual. If anything, it's quite common. Chechen groups in particular were replete with pairs of brothers and pairs of sisters operating together. And in many cases, it actually is a standard modus operandi of not just Chechen groups, but Irish groups. It's very, very common. And from the point of view of individuals who belong to an organization, it's very, very attractive to have that. It's attractive not just in terms of maintaining and ensuring operational security, because the individuals are far less likely to inform on the group, inform on each other, but it creates a very, very powerful psychological bond in terms of sustaining commitment and making sure that the offenders go through with the operation. We see many, many examples all the time of people who change their minds at the last moment. I've just returned back from a trip to Pakistan a number of weeks ago, where I met with members of the Pakistani Taliban, including a young suicide bomber who changed his mind literally at the last second. And that happens all the time. So there's a huge incentive for an organization or a group to engage siblings like this. Now I should clarify that we don't know yet if there is a broader context or a group pulling the strings in this particular case, but the idea of terrorist siblings is actually far more common than we might imagine.
And I do want to get to
pairs of brothers, pairs of sisters. Sometimes it's a younger versus older dynamic. At other times, we even have examples of terrorist twins.
I do want to get to the group, but I'm also intrigued by the fact that you talked to a would-be terrorist in Pakistan who changed his mind. Why did he change his mind?
We don't know. He doesn't know. This is the frustrating thing. We've found it over the years that many terrorists and former terrorists are willing to speak to us as academics. Many of them themselves struggle to make sense with what they've done. I think, you know, we tend to assume that there are very complicated reasons behind somebody's radicalization or somebody's increasing involvement in terrorism. Sometimes, particularly when there are family connections, people tend to drift further and further into terrorist violence without necessarily knowing why on earth they're actually doing it. So they may engage in this kind of activity without necessarily having thought it through very well. And at that moment where that key decision has to be made to press the trigger, it's very, very common for doubts to flood their minds, and sometimes, fortunately, they walk away, they pull back.
We're using the word terrorism and terrorist, and I want to ask you how you define that, because in preparation for the show, I was thinking of Adam Lanza, who, you know, shot up a school in Newtown, Connecticut, killing first graders, killing teachers, and yet we didn't use the word terrorist to describe his acts.
We tend to use terrorism whenever there appears to be a broader context to the activities. That broader context might be ideological, it might be political, it might be religious. But in contrast to, for example, a serial killer or a mass murderer, whose motivations tend to be far more personal and fantasy oriented. Whenever we invoke the word terrorism, it's usually because there is a broader context here. It certainly makes no difference if you're on the receiving end of this violence or you are bereaved as a result. But the difference is there is an immediate target, i.e. the victims, and then there is a broader target, which sometimes is a state, government that you're trying to communicate a broader message to.
But using
just don't know what that is in this case, yes.
Well, let me ask you, because if we're using the word terrorist, there's so much that we don't know about their political motivations or alleged political motivations or the reason for this this attack last week.
Correct. Well, I mean, 9 times out of 10, whenever there is an indiscriminate bombing like this, I mean, the word terrorism will be invoked. Mm-hmm. But that remains to be seen. I mean, there are elements of a radicalization story emerging from this. There are hints of foreign travel to where certainly the older brother Tamerlan may have received training. I mean, all of that is still just emerging piece by piece. But increasingly, it is looking like a terrorist story as opposed to a psychopathic serial killer type dynamic here.
Picking up, we were talking about siblings who might be aligned in terrorism, but I'm wondering about whether a group, whether it's a terrorist organization or a larger group, provides a kind of context that allows someone to do something they may not do by themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about that. In fact, it's quite common. We haven't seen any obvious claims of responsibility yet, but again, that's not unusual. I think, if anything, the past week's events have really brought home to me how there are still so many myths perpetrating about how these kinds of things unfold and how the drama unfolds. I mean, out of the tens of thousands of terrorist attacks we've seen all over the globe for decades now, it's surprising to most people, but the vast majority of those attacks don't actually go claimed. They don't go claimed. No, and we tend to, whenever attacks occur in particular regions, we can pretty much safely assume that they might be associated with one group or another. But in this case, it's just too early to know. As frustrating as an answer like that is, but we just don't know yet.
Well, I don't mind a frustrating answer if we can stay, you know, as close to what we know so far. I know that you have looked at the kind of psychology of terrorism or the psychology of a terrorist, and without going too much out on a limb, can you describe that for our listeners?
Well, sure. The first thing I would say, and I suspect your listeners aren't going to be happy to hear this, abandon all hope of ever getting a terrorist profile. We've been looking for one in the academic community for 40 years now, and the reality is we're not going to get one anytime soon, if ever. The story of terrorism, the story of the psychology of terrorism, is one that sees lots of different people becoming involved in lots of different ways for lots of different reasons. I've seen many people report over the last several days in interviews with friends and family members of Jahar and Tamerlan, things like, he couldn't have done this. This is very unlike him. He was such a nice guy. He seemed like a good guy. He wasn't like a terrorist. Very, very common to hear those kinds of things in the aftermath of an event like this. Now, I think that's for a couple of reasons. I mean, in some cases, although this might not be apparent, the people being interviewed by the media themselves didn't really have much contact with the person involved. So it might have been that they knew them 5-6 years prior to them becoming involved. So you can't necessarily take too much from that observation. But in other cases, I think it reveals an awful lot of the biases we have surrounding who or what a terrorist is and what precisely they do. There is this very worrying myth that's out there that because someone is a terrorist or because they intend to blow someone up in the kind of carnage we've seen, that they will give off behavior signatures that can be detected. And the idea that terrorists will always leak some kind of suspicious behavior like this, I think, is wishful thinking.
Well, you know what?
I'm
sorry, only because we have to take a very short break, and I want to pick up on what you just said. But first, I do need to reintroduce you. Take that short break, give out the phone number, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, that's John Horgan, director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism, also an associate professor of psychology at Penn State University, member of the Research Advisory Board of the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. He has written a number of books about terrorism, terrorists, interviewed terrorists himself. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, It's My Party, the Women in Comedy Project, a world premiere comedy written and directed by Jennifer Childs. Featuring an eclectic cast of Philadelphia actresses, It's My Party, the Women and Comedy Project dives into the many roles comedy plays in women's lives, exploring and exposing the real comedy of everyday life. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
WHYY's Quiet Campaign is underway. Do your part now to take a day off the start of our spring on-air membership drive. Make your gift at whyy.org/support. Our goal is to raise $25,000 before midnight on Tuesday. And if we make that goal, we'll keep Pledge Central quiet all day Wednesday. Join the Quiet Campaign. Make your gift now at whyy.org/support.
Holy Family University supports WHYY and is offering a graduate open house on Tuesday, April 23rd, beginning at 6 p.m. at the university's Newtown site in Bucks County. It's an opportunity to learn more about Holy Family's graduate programs in education, counseling psychology, criminal justice, business, nursing, and accelerated MBAs designed specifically to help balance school with work and life. Accepting applications now for a summer start. Details at holyfamily.edu/achieve.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with John Horgan, and as he just described to us, there's no discrete profile of terrorism. But nonetheless, John Horgan, I know that you have looked at people that might be more open to terrorist recruitment or radicalization, and perhaps that's a more fruitful conversation to have. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've done a lot of research on the process whereby people become involved in terrorism. So like I said, I mean, depending on who you are, depending on what you do in a terrorist group, what cause or claim you want to represent, there are multiple pathways in and there are multiple pathways out. It's not the same for everyone, but across all of the different cases, we've arrived at several very broad risk factors that help us in many ways make a distinction between the person who is radicalized versus the person who's become involved in terrorism. Because I think that's a key difference we failed to make, and we failed to make again this past week. There's no single catalyst event, or there's nothing that just happens to a person one day that says, well, now I want to go and become a terrorist. But there very often is a sense of victimization, whether it's real or imagined, that there is an enemy out there that wants to see the end of you. There are very strong expectations about involvement, whether it has to do with a sense of adventure, camaraderie, excitement, the kind of lures that pull people into to groups. Very often there's socialization through friends and family. And this is what I was saying earlier, a person may become involved in a terrorist campaign without necessarily being radical, without necessarily having a radical ideology to pin something on. Group psychology is key, of course. It might seem to be a little bit unusual, but from a psychological perspective, a group can be two or more people. So the fact that there are two people here, that in itself constitutes a group, and it means that there are different kinds of bonds, different kinds of dynamics that would separate a group of two people as opposed to, let's say, a lone actor terrorist. The lone actor terrorist, or the so-called lone wolf, is far more likely to arouse suspicion. They tend to give off far more suspicious behavior prior to engaging in what they do. And that's why I think there is a slight difference here between the kinds of lone wolf terrorists, the domestic lone wolf terrorists, and what we're seeing here, because from all accounts that I've seen, there are a lot of elements of control, of planning, of poise, of attempts to blend in, even after the attacks. Mm. So this is something slightly different here.
Well, I'm also flummoxed and curious about then taking those catalytic events. I mean, that someone is drawn to a group, they feel victimized, there's a kind of a group psychology. What is the step, though, that you would target innocents? And by that, I mean people at a Boston Marathon or people that are just living their lives on the street that have nothing to do with a government or a military. These are just folks living their life.
Well, that's not the view that the bombers would come to. I mean, it's a gradual process of dehumanization. It's not something that happens overnight. There are lots and lots of doubts that have to be overcome, because I've met with many bombers who describe themselves having gone through that process. They have to reduce any empathy they feel for the victim by for example, highlighting the fact that elected governments are elected by these same people. Mm. So this idea that that bystanders can claim innocence is not something that any successful terrorist will buy into. Another one of these myths is that terrorists don't feel guilt for what they don't feel guilty for what they do. The evidence says that they actually do in many cases, but they have to work very, very hard at reducing any empathy they might feel, and planting a bomb actually helps that, because you can plant a bomb and not necessarily be around when it goes off. And so that means from your perspective, you don't necessarily have to have any firsthand experience of the carnage that you are responsible for.
But are we talking about some degree of psychopathy? I mean, is there something psychopathic in this kind of thinking?
Not necessarily. By and large, psychopaths don't fit into terrorist movements, terrorist groups, because they tend to be quite unreliable. Psychopaths have a lot of difficulty in keeping their mouth shut. They don't have the kind of discipline and wherewithal that's needed before, during, and after events of this kind. And one terrorist recruiter that I interviewed many, many years ago, I asked him that very question. I said, you know, does your movement have psychopaths? And he said, he first got grossly offended that I would even ask him that. But he said, look, you know, I understand what you're trying to say here. But he said, no, we wouldn't hire them because, and his quote was, they would stick out like a sore thumb and everyone would know who they are.
Hmm. But there is a kind of ends justify the means thinking, though.
There is a mentality that is acquired as a result of spending time on one of these groups. So, I mean, they learn to keep a lid on these emotions. They learn control. They learn to maintain that kind of commitment. But that's something that they seek and they find in ideology. And that ideology might be political, it might be religious, it might be some combination of it, but it doesn't necessarily come from being psychopathic.
And why are we mostly talking about young men? There are young women who have engaged in terrorist acts, but why largely young men?
Well, terrorism, for the most part, at least in terms of operational acts like bombings and shootings, tends to be a young man's game. Mm. We see a lot of young men that are in search of the same kinds of things that terrorist groups will provide them: adventure, excitement, camaraderie, the ability to be part of something that is much bigger than them. When we're all young, we're always in search of something bigger than us, where our political, our social identities are still being formed. And terrorist groups are very, very good at providing answers to people in search of them.
But you mentioned the fact that people that have engaged in these acts of terrorism, many of them haven't expected to survive them. I mean, is there something, a sort of a death wish associated with that, or even a kind of strange martyrdom?
Well, martyrdom, yes. I mean, I don't think anybody engages in terrorist activity if they don't feel that they are going to achieve something in doing that that they would otherwise not be able to achieve in normal life. And sometimes it's about bringing them glory to a community. Sometimes it is about a martyrdom. In other cases, quite frankly, the reasons are far more tawdry and low level. I mean, it is about a recognition that they are not achieving anything of any significance in their day-to-day lives.
You had mentioned that some have felt guilt, meaning that they truly regret what they did, that they feel the kind of emotional pain that comes with guilt.
Oh, well, some do, not all, but some do. I mean, we have interviewed people who have managed to disengage from the terrorist group. I mean, they become disillusioned. They disengage. I wouldn't necessarily say that they've had a complete change of heart, but they start to disagree with some of the kinds of things that the group, some of the directions the group would go in. So, for example, I met with one Al-Qaeda member who talked about the fact that he was in his own mind morally, psychologically okay with the idea of killing soldiers, killing troops who were viewed by him as foreign invaders, but he actually drew the line at killing civilians. Mm. And as a result, he became disillusioned, because from his perspective, the focus became more about targeting Westerners, targeting non-combatants, civilians, sort of the target 101 of most terrorists, if you like.
Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. If you're just joining us, John Horgan is our guest, director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism at Penn State University, where he's also an associate professor of psychology. He's written a number of books about terrorism, interviewed terrorists himself, and he's a member of the Research Advisory Board of the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. Let's see what looks like Leela from Ardmore has to say. Leela, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Oh, yes, hello.
Hi.
I wanted to ask your speaker about something that we, I'm a retired teacher, I should say, that we had been told in the last years that I was teaching about the development of the frontal cortex of the brain and how a lot of these young kids really don't have full brain development until maybe their early to mid-20s. And it seems like a lot of these killers are in that age range, and so can they be held responsible if this is true for the, and it, you know, because they're unable to make decisions correctly until their brain is fully developed? I'd like to hear some response. Sure. I haven't heard anybody talk about this.
Okay, fair enough. Let me give John Horgan a chance to respond. What do you think?
Thank you, Leela. Good question. Short answer is no. It's a lot of that is actually based on junk science. It's not really supported by any kind of rigorous evidence or rigorous science. And the problem we have with a lot of those kinds of projections is that there's virtually no predictive ability. I mean, there are lots of people who suffer from those kinds of issues, but to say that that would somehow predict not just even risk of engagement in terrorism, but risk of engagement in violent behavior, the science is nowhere near being able to make that kind of connection.
Leela, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. John Horgan, you talk about disengagement, and I guess I'm interested in this, if there is a process of disengagement.
Yes, there is actually a process of disengagement. We just don't tend to pay too much attention to it. But just like there is a flood of people who become involved in terrorism, there's also a flood of people who leave. Some leave because they have to leave. Others leave because they want to leave. They become disillusioned. One of the reasons why we have spent so much time speaking to former terrorists about why they become disillusioned is for us to capture that knowledge and use it to try to prevent people becoming involved in terrorism in the first place. I was very, very, very struck by the fact that, you know, when I went around the world, I interviewed people, I interviewed IRA members in Northern Ireland, I interviewed Al-Qaeda members in the UK and Saudi Arabia, I interviewed the people involved with the Bali bombers in Indonesia, and I was struck by a common thread right throughout those interviews. They became disillusioned because of the huge gaping chasm between the kinds of expectations they had about what being a terrorist was and the reality of involvement. The reality really wasn't all that it was cracked up to be, and so I think there is powerful lessons to be learned in terms of how we can make known the difference, I suppose, between the fantasy and the reality. Might do a far better job of undermining the allure of involvement for many would-be terrorists.
I'm also curious about whether you have interviewed people that have essentially retained the politics that might have gone on with their terrorism but stopped the terrorist acts.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it goes back to something that we talked about at the very beginning of our discussion this morning, the distinction between radicalization and terrorism. Mm-hmm. And for us, we've had to make a distinction in our research between disengagement and de-radicalization. You can leave behind the terrorist organization, but you can still retain those ideas. Because there is an assumption out there that you have to change the way you think in order to get out of terrorism. It's not necessarily the case. People drift away. They start to have kids. They have a midlife crisis. They want to just get on with their lives and do something else. They might even still remain involved in some very distant way in the organization or the movement. They might become involved in fundraising activities or just, you know, engaging in propaganda, going on marches, things like that. But they move to a different kind of role, and we see that all the time.
Let me get some more callers in our conversation, then we're going to have to say goodbye to you, John Horgan, and get a second guest in. Looks like we have Michelle from Abington joining us on Radio Times. Michelle, go ahead. You're on the
Hi.
Air. Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question was about cognitive dissonance, so holding two conflicting cognitions, like one to, you know, the human need to not hurt people versus these terrorist acts. So the constant need to justify oneself is reason enough to go mad, or if it's enough to lose control of yourself, and also how terrorist recruiters would manipulate that need to be at peace with oneself to get these young men to commit terrorist acts.
Michelle, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. John Horgan, go ahead.
Great question, Michelle. This is where some of our interviews with terrorist recruiters have actually been very, very useful for us. They wouldn't necessarily use the term cognitive dissonance, but they recognize that as being common. So they try to turn it on its head. They try to emphasize the fact that they don't necessarily recruit everyone to the groups. They try to make it very, very clear to prospective recruits that it is a great honor, a great privilege to be part of the group, such that when they are accepted into the movement, there really isn't that much room for certainly any kind of outward dissonance. That if there are doubts, that this dynamic actually encourages the individuals to keep their mouths shut, to keep these doubts to themselves. Many of the former terrorists that we spoke to actually said, look, I became disillusioned because I just wasn't able to maintain this facade anymore. I knew we were killing civilians. I couldn't see any point to it. Mm. This wasn't what I was led to believe was what this struggle was all about. But they remained engaged in the movement because they felt that there was just no way out. They couldn't resolve this dissonance, to use your phrase, in any way inside the group. So this is why very often people will remain in the group without necessarily even being committed to it.
Michelle, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And John Horgan, just a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. So as this story unfolds, and because of your expertise, I want to know what you are looking for, waiting to find out.
What I'm actually waiting to find out is something I wouldn't normally be especially interested in, but I am actually deeply concerned about the way in which our coverage has unfolded at these events over the past week. I think much of the resilience that we saw in communities in the United States generally in the post 9/11 period, I actually see that as being substantially damaged. Hmm. There's a lot of talk about preventing the next attack and spotting the next attack, spotting suspicious behavior. The reality here is that these kinds of small scale, do it yourself terrorist attacks are virtually impossible to prevent.
And that's
a very, very difficult thing to hear. I take no satisfaction out of saying that, but this is the reality of low-level 21st century terrorism. Fortunately for us, I mean, most of the do-it-yourself terrorists tend to fail, but in cases like this with a young kid who buys materials at a department store and is inspired by instructions he got over the Internet, it's practically impossible to spot. And I think we need to do a far better job of not buying into political messages either from either side of the political spectrum here, and to understand that we can live with this. I mean, it isn't going to change our way of life, and we need to be very, very careful about not overreacting in the ways that we have, because my ultimate fear is that the kind of reactions we had last week might actually inspire copycats.
Well, we could go on much more to talk about. John Horgan, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. Anytime. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism and an associate professor of psychology at Penn State University. As I said, the author of a number of books about terrorism and terrorists. He's also a member of the Research Advisory Board of the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. Rem Ryder, waiting in the wings, will be talking about how the press did last week. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Choose PA Wind supports WHYY and encourages energy consumers in Pennsylvania to power their businesses and homes with energy from in-state wind farms. More on clean, local wind power online at choosepawind.com/Philly.
Bryn Mawr Film Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY, presents Critically Acclaimed, an evening with your favorite film critics on Friday, May 10th at 6 p.m. A.O. Scott, Kerry Rickey, Stephen Ray, and Lisa Schwartzbaum will compare notes on beloved films, debate the future of film criticism, and answer questions. Dedicated to Roger Ebert, there will also be a private dinner with the critics where guests can challenge them one-on-one. For more information, BrynMawrFilm.org.
The story of the Boston bombings as an act of terrorism put our nation on edge. As authorities continued their investigation, citizens have been asked to stay strong. But that's hard to do when we have felt so much. On the next Voices in the Family, psychologist Dan Gottlieb explores a sense of vulnerability that stretches beyond Boston and discusses ways to transcend this national trauma. Join us for this very special program today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Widener supports WHYY. A graduate degree from Widener University is designed to help be the difference in your career. Widener University offers graduate degrees in programs including clinical psychology, business, and more. Registration at widener.edu/graduate.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Last week, the unfolding saga of the bombings at the Boston Marathon was the top news story. The public was glued to their TVs, their radios, computers, and mobile devices for updates. So how did the news media do covering this dramatic and tragic chain of events? Joining us now is Rem Ryder, editor and senior vice president of American Journalism Review. That's a national magazine based at the University of Maryland's Merrill College of Journalism, covers digital print and broadcast journalism. And Rem Ryder, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Going back to last week, and it's not over today, what do you think the media's role perhaps should have been or is under circumstances as they unfolded last week in Boston?
Well, the media obviously have a huge responsibility in an event like this where you have a public just so hungry to understand what's going on, to know all the details. As you said, people glued to television and to radio and to the Internet. And so you kind of have competing goals here. Obviously, the most important thing is to be thorough and responsible and careful. But there's that age-old tension of getting it first. Some people think it's kind of an outmoded concept now, but sadly, in the rush to get things quickly, you have mistakes. And that's why we kind of had a mixed picture last week. There was a lot of very good work by a lot of news organizations, but I think a lot of attention was focused on the high profile of mistakes of CNN and the AP and other news organizations when they said that a suspect was in custody Wednesday long before one was. It's some just atrocious behavior by the New York Post and some very controversial actions on social media.
Well, and I want to get to all of them. You mentioned the New York Post. I'm looking at their cover of last week. Big letters, bag men, Fed seek. These two pictured at Boston Marathon. These were two young men, clearly not the suspects. Nonetheless, there they were on the New York Post.
Yeah, just baffling and completely irresponsible. There was some small typo on that page saying that these weren't necessarily suspects, but hardly anybody's going to see that. They're going to see the pictures of two young men who it turned out had absolutely nothing to do with this horrific crime. And just to throw that out there with the headline bag men, which obviously is a connotation of people who run errands for criminals, it's just kind of, even for the New York Post, which is not exactly a paragon of journalism ethics, this was just awful.
Well, and apparently they also had reported earlier on last week that there was a Saudi who was a suspect being held in custody at a hospital. And turns out he was not a suspect at all. In fact, he was apparently or reportedly a victim of last week's bombings.
Exactly right. I mean, they were just so off the rails that it's hard to understand this. They had the Saudi story you mentioned. And they also had a story early in the week that 12 people had been killed rather than three. And they kind of stubbornly clung to this, and in spite of the fact that clearly there weren't 12 dead. And one of the things that what always bothers me in cases like that is when there's a big mistake and the news organization doesn't own up to it, because kind of the best thing you can do when you've screwed something up and it's obvious is to take responsibility for it. You know, people are even journalists are human, and you're going to have mistakes. And it always seems to be the best thing you can do is just say, okay, we blew it, and we'll try not to do it again. But last week, there was kind of this digging in where CNN never really had a full-throated apology for its bad story. And the Post, the same was true there. And the AP sort of clung to its story for a while that a suspect was in custody. Never really said, oh, we screwed up. But it seems to me that's one of the lessons we've seen is the best thing you can do is when you've made a mistake, in terms of damage control, you know, is to say it, just to admit it, because it's not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do.
Well, I mean, it's hard as a human being to admit mistakes, but do you think, I mean, why is it so hard for the press to do that, do you think? And that's, of course, a very broad question.
Well, I'm puzzled by that, because it's kind of a stepping back. I mean, where I think we've seen some progress in that area. Generally, journalism has gotten somewhat better at correcting mistakes, at showing, being more prominent in displaying corrections. And part of that's a necessity, because we're in such a different world now that, 20 years ago, you might have made a mistake and only maybe people in your direct area knew about it. Now, in the age of Twitter, everybody knows about it. And it seemed to me that, for example, when CNN got the healthcare decision wrong last year, they very quickly admitted it and said they would try to avoid similar things in the past. Whereas Fox, which made the same mistake, kind of stonewalled and dug in. And that's why the kind of backsliding this time, I think, is really troubling.
Well, John King said on Wednesday that the suspect was a, quote, dark-skinned male, basically saying that the suspect had been taken or at least identified or captured by the police. And they were wrong, as were other organizations as well. Is that because everyone was following everybody else? And if there was a breaking news item like that, people wanted to be first on that?
Well, I think clearly people wanted to be first on that, and sometimes you can pay. It's an understandable impulse, but you can really pay a price for it. I think news organizations care more about it than the public does, frankly. But actually, in this case, not everybody ran with it. I mean, that's one of the, you know, as I mentioned, there was a lot of terrific journalism done in the past week, and one of the healthy signs is that under great pressure, and you can imagine in the newsroom what the pressure is when other people are going with the fact that somebody's that the suspect's in custody and you don't have it, you're afraid you're kind of look clueless to your audience. But a lot of people held back, and NBC, particularly the reporting of Pete Williams, their Justice Department correspondent, was terrific all week. And he for one, you know, never went with that story. CBS, whilst both of them went on the air saying, no, there hasn't been an arrest. So it was not like an unmitigated, bunch of lemmings running to the sea saying somebody's in custody. There were, at some news organizations, there was very independent judgment exercise.
But do you think that was, in the case of Pete Williams, just the fact that he has spent so many years covering the Justice Department in Washington, probably has a lot of very good contacts there? I mean, do you think it was individual reporters or something about news organizations themselves?
I think it's a mix of both, but certainly make a good point about Pete Williams. It's an important thing to keep in mind that there's no substitute for the kind of expertise you have when you have somebody who's been on a beat for a long time and is really plugged in. And what happens in these mega events is that there are an awful lot of law enforcement agencies involved. You know, there's the FBI, there's the, you know, state and local police. There's just a lot of players, and all sources aren't created equal. And I think that's where we get some of the mistakes, where that you talk to somebody who's a law enforcement source, but they don't have firsthand knowledge. And I think that's where the pressure really is on, is to make sure that they really know what they're telling you.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Beth from Morrisville joining us. Beth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was listening, actually, as you guys were doing the live broadcast when the pictures were released of the two bombing suspects. And I remember the gentleman on your station, I do listen to NPR all the time,
right.
The gentleman said, well, we look at these pictures and we see that they're Caucasian. Now, I understand being PC, and I am a liberal, and I believe in, you know, not judging books by their cover, but I felt like the description could have been a little more accurate.
Such as how? I mean, what would have been more accurate than Caucasian, Beth?
They have dark hair. One has long, curly, bushy hair.
Meaning
things
what?
Things of that sort, and so saying, oh, you know, they're Caucasian. That's pretty vague. And I feel like it was almost too much effort to be PC. And no one wants to go up and say, oh, they're Muslim, whatever,
right.
You know. And that would be, a terrible way to just describe a person. But I do feel like you could have been a little less concerned with PC and a little more informative for people who were actually listening
but
might have seen these people.
But what does a Muslim look like? I mean, they're Muslims. They cover the gamut, don't they, in terms of appearance?
Yeah, and I would have been offended if they had said that. I'm not trying to say that that's what they should have said. But if they could have just said, these guys look to be about 6 foot tall, they have dark hair, they have, they have darker eyebrows, instead of saying, oh, they're Caucasian. It's just not helpful.
Let me see what Rim Ryder has to say. Beth, thanks for calling into Radio Times. I'm curious about your response, Rim.
Well, I wasn't listening at the time, but I think you've always got to be really careful with those descriptions, because sometimes the John King thing is a perfect case, that the dark skin. I mean, that's really not giving much information. That's hardly ruling out. It's hardly pinpointing somebody, and I think sometimes we're too quick to characterize. One person. Caucasian-looking person can to look like something else to someone, to a different viewer. So I think it's really important to be really cautious in those descriptions.
Beth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Ren, let me ask you about the role of social media, and of course it plays a significant role in news events. And I do want to talk about Reddit and how Reddit got some things wrong. But broadly speaking, do you see social media playing an important role in this unfolding story?
Yeah, social media played an enormous role, as it does increasingly in the news environment. And sometimes social media played a good debunking role in terms of knocking down bad stories. The flip side is that social media, you can very quickly have transmitted, you can have some bad stories that get instant circulation and credibility. And in this case, the Reddit phenomenon was something I think was really new. On the social media site Reddit, a bunch of people decided that they were going to solve this crime, and so they names were thrown out and pictures posted of people who had absolutely nothing to do with it. It's sort of similar to what we were talking about with the New York Post. Clearly, the old media doesn't have any monopoly on irresponsibility, and I thought this was kind of chilling. The kind of the cavalier way in which people were being pinpointed, and with a local angle here in Philadelphia, the missing Brown student from Radnor, who was named for a while on Reddit as one of the suspects. And imagine this was initially well intentioned, but I don't think anybody thought through what they were doing. This kind of digital witch hunt, pinpointing people as criminals in a horrific crime, just completely irresponsibly.
I mean, almost a kind of vigilantism, do you think?
I think it approached that. I mean, some of the people close to Reddit have denied that. But I don't know what else to call it. If you're out there, you're basically, putting a scarlet letter on people, many of them innocent people. It's just, to me, this was just out of control.
Let me see what Michael from Wynwood has to say. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I had a question for your author, which was about the lack of an actual concise and coherent definition across for terrorism across the various counter-terrorist agencies, and how within a sociological framework, it's more appropriate to say terrorist acts or acts of terrorism or individuals will perpetrate that as opposed to terrorists, and how the use of such terminology could impact the way that the public views it and responds to it, and if it could overshadow the fundamental question that people want, which is like, why commit such an act, how that plays out.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Rem, he's referring to our first guest, John Horgan, who has interviewed terrorists and has looked at some of the, I guess, the not exactly psychological profile of terrorists, but the various ways that someone might be attracted to this. And we were talking about the use of the word terrorist and why that has so many different meanings, depending on who's talking.
Well, it was interesting this week that at the beginning of the week, President Obama was very cautious before applying that label. There's kind of a inflammatory label, and nevertheless, I'm not sure what else you call it. If this isn't terrorism, I don't know what is.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye here. Sometimes it's the tone people use as much as the words that they use, and I, like everyone else, was flipping all the channels yesterday to try to keep up with, or last week trying to keep up with this story. And I have to say, there were people that were just being literally just hysterical in their descriptions and supposed analysis of what was going on.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a problem, and one of the. I mean, yes, it's a very, it's a very tumultuous time and a huge story, but it's all the more reason that the journalists and the people that they interview on television, the radio, really need to bend over backwards to be responsible and keep the tone as well as the words appropriate.
About 30 seconds, we have to say goodbye. So, what do you hope the press has learned this week?
Well, it's a lesson that the press keeps learning and then unlearning. I mean, we saw so many mistakes after Sandy Hook, after the shootings in the children in Connecticut, and you'd hope that there would be a carryover. But I did see as the week came on after the early mistakes here in the coverage, a lot more attempts to make sure that their journalists were not saying more than they knew, and so at least short term, a positive impact. So I'll be Pollyannish and hope maybe it'll carry over.
One can hope so. Rem Ryder, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, my pleasure.
He's editor, senior vice president of American Journalism Review. That's a national magazine based at the University of Maryland's Merrill College of Journalism, covering digital print and broadcast journalism. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and tell us what you think of this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.